Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
It might surprise you to learn that the same person who's responsible for helping start Riot Girl and fronting the bands Bikini Kill and La Tigra
was also the source of the phrase, "smells like teen spirit." Hello, and welcome to SupDoc.
I'm George Chen.
And I'm Parker Romaine.
On today's episode, we'll be mansplaining with our guest, Hutch Harris from The Thermals.
Yeah, he picked the 2013 doc, The Punk Singer, about musician Kathleen Hanna and how she became one of the most famous feminist icons for a new generation of women.
Here's us and Hutch in the basement of Lost Weekend Video. Hutch.
Hey.
Hutch Harris, welcome.
Hutch.
To our basement. First time you've been down here.
Yeah, first time.
And you're going to be doing a show here. Okay, so for those who don't know, Hutch is a musician, been in primarily Thermals, doing some other stuff or some solos.
Mostly the Thermals now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And and how recently did you start doing stand-up?
Just over a year ago.
Oh, nice.
So how is it treating you?
I love it.
Wow.
Yeah. This'll be the first time tonight. Actually, I'm not totally doing stand-up tonight, but yeah, this trip.
It's storytelling.
I haven't
tonight.
Done San Francisco before.
Yeah. And
but
you're
yeah,
from San Jose?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, yeah, because we are also music people. We all have been in bands.
Yeah, I knew you.
And we all do comedy
20
now.
Plus years ago.
Yeah.
I think I met you like at
we went to
Cupertino
the same,
Library.
I think we went to the same high school. So, and you were saying, I saw you on Twitter saying that you remember seeing Bikini Kill Knights of Columbus.
Yeah.
I was at that show.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
It was a July 4th show.
Now, who
I feel... Double Flyer somewhere.
There was like...
Mohinder played with
Okay,
with
I knew someone
Kill.
Else. Okay. I mean, I feel like there was another big band, like maybe Bratmobile? I feel
no,
like there was
the
another
Tourette's.
Big Olympia. Okay, yeah.
The reason
yeah.
I remember this is I still have the flyer somewhere. And there Not was rad. This recent like Riot Girl show, art show.
Uh-huh.
That I think came to Portland, the Alien
yeah,
Show.
It, yeah, it was there too.
My friend Cece Moss helped curate with Austria.
Oh, cool.
Super Rock. So I actually gave her a bunch of my old early 90s flyers. Like
nice.
I had like Excuse 17.
Oh, yeah.
Like the Heavens to Betsy Excuse 17
yeah.
tour
yeah.
flyer, which is Proto Sleater-Kinney. So yeah, I remember having that Bikini Kill flyer. And I remember that was. Pretty insane because it was just the suburbs. I don't even remember the Knights of Columbus in Cupertino. It was like, it's not even like a rock venue really at all. There was a couple shows happening.
No, there. It was like another venue that got shut down because remember someone stole the shield and someone stole
oh.
a bunch of beer. It was every venue yeah. lasts like 6 months
it
gets shut down.
Was
but
it
that...
A- Was it Sorry. A real Knights of Columbus, or was it a place called?
You
I think
out.
So. Yeah,
yes.
yeah. I mean, like it was a working.
It's the Catholic thing. Like
yeah,
Catholics
yeah.
go to Knights of Columbus
yeah.
and drink.
I mean, that's like the DIY show idea is that you just like go to like a YMCA or
yeah.
in our where we're from, there was a library that had. It actually saw pretty amazing shows at this.
Oh
library
yeah, like Three Mile Pilot and like yeah,
yeah.
It, yeah, the DIY thing is you go to a place that doesn't want you to have shows there, and you somehow convince them to let
right.
you have shows
exactly.
there.
Exactly like comedy. That's
yeah,
like
yeah,
why we're
like
yeah.
why
just
we're in the
go
basement
where you're
of
not
a video
wanted.
Store.
Yeah.
Exactly. So and Paco, you said that you actually saw Bikini Kill before.
I saw Bikini Kill at Club Soda in Kalamazoo, Michigan, probably 91, I would say.
That would've been yeah. That's where they played a bar, yeah.
Yeah. 91, 92, or maybe 90, 91, something along those
the
lines.
The show we saw was probably like 95 or 94,
yeah,
right?
probably one of those.
Probably 94.
Yeah. I think they stopped being, when did they stop being a band? 96, 97?
97, they broke
Yeah,
up,
I remember yeah. them doing a tour with the Go-Go's. Do you remember that at all?
Yeah.
Like a Go-Go's reunion with Bikini Kill opening.
Wow.
Playing like venues like the Warfield.
You did wow. play, and you know what? You know, I forgot, I saw them twice because they did a Gilman show. Bikini Kill did a Gilman show
yeah.
a couple days before that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
she had to kind of do like the...
Was that the same
disclaimer,
tour?
Like,
yeah.
we're not sellouts just because we're playing with the Go-Go.
Oh, like it was that same year then, yeah. I saw them at Gilman, so it might have been the same tour also.
Yeah, yeah, it's probably 95.
I remember ordering... Well, okay, so before we get too deep in the weeds, mm-hmm. We asked you to do the show, and you chose... Well, we had a couple of options, but yeah, we decided to go with the punk singer.
Wanted to do a music one.
I was like, let's do that because I know you and I are probably closer to that world than we are to Keith
Richards. Definitely. I mean, I had seen it a couple. I actually watched it again last night just because it had been a while since I saw it, but I really like that.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the movie.
And this doc came out in 2014?
I think what happened was there's a Kickstarter to do it, and I think it first debuted at South by Southwest in 2013, so it might be a slightly different cut. I was kind of looking back at Sini Anderson is the filmmaker, and I was looking back through her Kickstarter page for the movie, and there was some notes about like she first time she showed it to Kathleen, it was a 3-hour cut.
Whoa.
So she got it down to like 90, 98. So
I never even heard of it. I didn't even know this was out. I liked
it. Yeah, it's
it
on Netflix.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it came through the Roxy when it was through San Francisco. But San Francisco, I think, was very connected to Riot Girl. It's interesting because I have a thought about the way people talk about. If there was a band that was a female punk band in the 90s, sometimes people would just throw Riot Girl at them.
Definitely. Yeah.
And I feel like it's a little bit, it's not quite the same as No Wave, where like some people, if they're really strict, they're like, there's only 4 No Wave bands.
Yeah.
And it's the 4 bands on No New York. It's not like Riot Girl was only the Pacific Northwest, but it was heavily the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Where you're currently there. And I feel like that's where there's like a long legacy that probably is like the fact that there's things like Girls Rock Camp started in Portland.
Yeah, and you think of most Riot Girl either being on Kill Rock Stars or K.
Yeah.
And coming, mostly from Olympia.
And that weird connection between Olympia and DC that was like the Discord connection.
Yeah, right.
Hugely, a slightly different aesthetic, but Huggy Bear, huge band.
Yeah.
That was in that world, but they were British.
They were on Kill Rock Stars, too.
They did records for
Kill Rock Stars. Yeah.
So it's all like heavily tied into this label. You were on that label?
We were, yeah. But I was just thinking last night when I was watching that documentary how the Kill Rock Stars that we were on is quite different from what it was back then. I mean, really, like once...
Every label is, probably.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. I mean, same as when we were on Sub Pop, it was totally different. And now, even like a couple years later, Kill Rock Stars is totally different. They mostly do comedy records.
Right,
now.
So you could end up on that label again.
Yeah, I can get back on.
Same contract.
But the cool thing about Kill Rock Stars is now they're doing records like Cameron Esposito, Hari Kondabolu, like in a lot
Bells,
of ways, and they're doing Rhea Butcher's records, so in some way it's like
still
getting back
queer.
To the... Yeah, yeah. Well, and also it's getting back to like the Riot Girl... Roots or
like
whatever.
The first
like
record to spoken word record, I think, on Kill Rock Stars.
Is it Slims?
It might be Slims, but there is a couple of those early 7-inches that were all like spoken word.
Yeah, yeah.
When the label started. So now, do you remember seeing Bikini Kill? Did you have any experience? Did you watch La Tigre ever?
I was remembering this last night too. How we Thermals opened. The last East Coast Leader Kenny tour before they broke up.
Oh, wow.
And when we played a couple of shows with them in New York, and then they did a benefit show that was La Tigre, Lou Reed, Margaret Cho, Sandra Bernhardt, and Sleater Kinney. And everyone only did like, I know, right? Like, that's crazy. But Lou Reed did the most like cliched thing you could think of for Lou Reed to do. He did spoken word. He just recited the lyrics for Walk on the Wild Side. It was like a parody of Lou Reed.
Wow.
But Margaret Cho was amazing. Sandra Bernhardt, it was like one of the best comedy sets I ever saw.
Yeah.
And then like Sleater Kinney did like 2 or 3 songs and La Tigre did a couple songs. And that was the only time I saw La Tigre.
One thing I didn't know when I watched it, but I thought about, so someone pointed out to me, some of the footage is just from like archival footage. It's interviews that other people had been doing. Like someone said, like, oh, that Toby Vail interview is from the EMP project.
Yeah, but it's like cool that they have that.
Yeah.
I mean,
one of the
things that struck me about the punk singer was like how much footage there was like of them playing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then those old, like a lot of the old interviews are really interesting because they're really telling. Like when one of the ones that struck me is when Toby talks about they just ask her to generally describe how things work in the band, and she's like, oh, we can't agree on anything. We can't talk about it because it's always changing. You can really tell how much they weren't getting along at that point.
What is Bikini Kill? Bikini Kill is forever in flux, and it's completely impossible for us to discuss it because it's always changing, and that's why it's really hard for us to do interviews, and also because all four of us don't agree on anything ever, and it's really difficult to sort out like what you can actually say about it.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
A USA Today reporter came and then wrote this really condescending thing about what we were doing and focused on what our clothes look like and what our bodies look like, and we must all be sexual abuse survivors because we're singing about rape, and therefore, you know, nobody has any imagination or knows anybody who's had things happen to them, so we must all have had these tragic histories.
It was really frustrating to a lot of us, especially that another woman would write something that we thought was so stupid. So we just decided to stop thinking about it and talking about it and just not answering the phone when journalists called. And that was what everybody called a press blackout.
It was really interesting how, like, you know, at one point there was the media blackout from Bikini Kill. They just, like, stopped talking to people because every interview they did, especially, you know, printed, the words were always, you know, they were always misrepresented. Like,
yeah, no, I mean, well, that is an interesting thing. I was going to go back to, I think it was, must have been 92 or so, whenever there was a huge, like, alternative newspaper article about Riot Grrrl, because that's almost, I think, where I first heard about it.
Yeah.
And there was, like, this thing of, like, oh, this is, we have to, or the narrative has been taken out of our hands by a reporter. And they were really, like, yeah, they wanted to, like, control the narrative and, like, not speak to reporters. It was also, like around the same time, like, Fugazi was doing similar things. Like, they wouldn't really do mainstream press interviews and things like
that. Well, but yeah. Kathleen said it was predicated, basically, on the reporter saying that her father had raped her, and it was false.
Yeah.
And she was like, well, right. Fuck that. You're just reporting whatever you want to report. You're not doing any factual checks. Mm-hmm. And she was like, we're just going to not talk to the press anymore. Mm-hmm. So, which, you know, makes sense.
And it is also at that point that, you know, you're saying that, like, all these bands are mislabeled as Riot Grrrl after that. Like, after, you know, the mainstream found out about it. I remember them, like, seeing the Breeders described as a Riot Grrrl band. Right. And I was like, I love the Breeders, but they're the farthest. They're just not, you know, they're not like that.
Yeah, I think, like, 20 years later, like, someone who was not around that scene would just, like, lump those things, even though they have like very different origins.
Yeah,
or like someone even on your thing said, "Oh, talk to Babes in Toyland."
Yeah,
but like that, they weren't
really
part of that.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I think there is like a clear, like, there's clearly what's really cool about it is, like, it's very, because knowing some people that have been like, oh, at the very start of a movement, it is funny how it is just like, oh, we just did this thing. It seemed totally natural that we would like make a zine or make this manifesto or do whatever. Like, the, you know, having hung out with like Jell-O, for example, it's like, oh, you basically invented punk rock. Great. And it's like, this is another person who, like, you can trace this entire movement. And it's interesting because it's the impact that it had spread so far, and to the point where it's like things like Pussy Riot are directly connected to Bikini Kill.
Yeah.
So I did think of in a minute about, you know, does it leave out other people to just focus on Kathleen? I mean, she has a whole arc that a lot of other people didn't have, but does it leave out people like Toby Vale, who is also in Bikini Kill and also very key to
I mean, it does, but it's not like they made a movie about Bikini Kill and then it just ended up being about Kathleen.
Yeah.
Like, Kathleen is obviously, you know, watching all those performances, like, very, very serious, but then very funny too, and very, just like a really great performer.
Yeah.
And a really good, like, front person for a band. Like, it's not like an accident that, you know, people loved her and people loved the band. It's because she's like so magnetic, and you can just, like, in those performances, you know, it's amazing. It's really cool to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's obvious how people could follow her and fall in love with her just watching what she was doing on stage. And just like her balls, I mean, she had so much charisma and confidence, you know, like the part where when she has a modeling, or rather she has a fashion show in the library, and they're like, we're 18. Like, what do we know about this? And she's just like, I'm just going to have a fashion show.
Yeah. So confident.
Yeah.
I feel like that's like that's like an evergreen kind of thing too.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's just like the school that's like, I guess the closest thing we have around here would be UC Santa Cruz, where it's just like, make your own major, do whatever, and it's going to be completely supported.
Well, and Kathleen and Kathy, they both went to Evergreen, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, there was other bands, like Bratmobile is another key band around that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love Bratmobile.
Yeah. And I think Allison's in the film, too.
Yes.
A lot of people are who else is in the film that was interesting to hear from? Lynn Breedlove from Tribe 8.
She's the coolest.
Yeah,
in that movie. Yeah,
yeah. It's like she's got this like Carhartt jacket on or something.
Yeah, yeah. She's just really cool and tough.
She is. I actually couldn't figure out who she was because I think I missed the part in the doc where they maybe flashed her name or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was the entire time. I'm like, God, who is? I loved her too.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, I couldn't figure out where she was coming from or who she was.
It's a great band, too. Now, did you ever see them in San Jose?
I never saw Tribe 8. I felt like I was very influenced by Riot Girl, but it felt strange. Well, not strange. I don't know. I think the idea of, like, being an ally or like, intersectionality was not really there in the early 90s. So it was this weird thing of, like, I am so glad this is happening. I would like to help. I don't really know how.
Yeah, as a man, when you're young, and a young man too, you know, because think you're like 18 or 19,
and also like a straight man who's like kind of like already just like I'm just putting all women on a different pedestal.
Yeah,
it started to be what happened.
It seems like the way you could help then was to get in the back of the room and just and just shut up and watch and let the girls get to the front of the stage and not get hurt.
Well, as a small man, I also had to be like, I did not do well in a pit. That sitting was another
on the
issue.
Sitting on the shoulders of women.
Well, I mean, when we talked to Pete Rojas about decline of Western civilization, and we got in a sideline into talking about Riot Girl, but he brought up an interesting thing of like, it was also created a safe, or not maybe not safe space. It created some space that men who were not hyper masculine could identify it with.
Did you know about her friendship with Kurt Cobain before you saw the documentary, or was that something you learned through the doc?
I did know. I feel like just that story of spray painting Smells Like Teen Spirit was famous, but yeah, I didn't really know. Yeah, I don't think I knew like a lot about their friendship or about like her personal life before I saw that movie.
I didn't know about her. I didn't know that story at all. I just learned that from the documentary that she spray painted Smells Like Teen Spirit on his rental wall in his house.
There is a fun story of her telling that story online. There was some storytelling show in New York, which came out before this came out. I don't know if you've seen that. I think it's called.
No.
I don't remember the name of it. I linked it to you. But if you just look for Kathleen Hanna Smells Like Teen Spirit on YouTube, you'll find it. And it's before this movie comes out, and she just tells the story of firstly that, and then also like being on tour with some band of bros, and then like that band coming to where she's stripping later that night, and then them putting that song on the jukebox.
What?
So her just having this complete like... But it's funny because I think a lot of people, and I think this movie brings out a lot of like her humor and her personality, because I think a lot of people had this assumption about Riot Girl and Bikini Kill that they were, you know, like,
it was humorless.
Humorless and the dour.
Yeah.
And she's super charming and funny and self-deprecating in that talk.
Yeah.
So I thought that comes out in the doc, but I almost feel like seeing that one little YouTube clip to me, like sort of was like, oh, that's like so much of her personality is there. And in the doc, you're also dealing with this narrative of illness.
Yeah.
Which you kind of discover later on. Like about the last third of it is kind of dealing with illness.
Yeah, that clip was telling about, you could see that she's come so far in her, obviously she's much older now, and she can look back on stuff with a little bit more humor. But it also displays kind of a very unglamorous photo of her that she pokes fun at herself. She's passed out.
Yeah.
I think she's half naked.
Well, I didn't know if that was actually her or not, because I thought the face was blacked out. But I thought it was like, yeah, they were kind of like referencing it.
Yeah, and she, that band, it's like the Heathens or something. I can't remember. I wish I could remember.
The backing band.
Yeah, the all guy. No, the band.
That was on the tour. Yeah, that came to her strip.
They were asking her what Bikini Kill was like, and she said, you know, for hours she was explaining feminism to them, and then later on she's at the strip club where she works, and they come in and put that song on.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the time when I was younger, when I didn't know that much about her being a stripper, but she has like no conflict about that at all. It's like totally integrated into her whole thing. It's like, I do this thing as a job, and it's also, it helps me pay for my band.
Well, it's cool too, because she's not gonna, her whole thing is she's, no one else is going to define feminism for her.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
It's her choice. Like, no one can tell her, well, you're not a feminist. And people would try to. You're not a feminist if you act this way on stage and then you're a stripper. Like, that's not for anyone else to say.
Right. That's like, well, I guess when they talk about this as third wave feminism, it's sort of a response to, there was a lot of sex negative kind of feminism in the 80s that this is like in opposition to in some ways. It's just like, it's a new energy to feminism that happened in the 90s, and it's all around this punk rock sort of DIY part of it.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot of it. Like, the way that it started is just like, people just basically are like, we're going to start a consciousness raising session. We're just going to have a meeting for women that are in the punk scene.
Well, yeah.
Like, that's a lot of the beginning of it.
And it's cool, because it is like, they are specifically setting out to create this scene or to, like, you know, create this new part of an existing scene that is, intentional in a good way.
And I feel like they were even, like, taking, like, ideologies or, like, methodologies from, like, you know, like a Black Power movement and things like that, and trying to, like, reapply them in new ways. So I think it's, like, it's the what happened in that moment seems to have, like, had a huge impact in ways that are, like, kind of hard to define, because it's it's a form of new form of protest music, and musically nothing has really changed. This is what I think is interesting. I'm saying, like, when Riot Girl came along, I don't think musically it was challenging in like an avant-garde way at all.
It's purely
like the politics and the ideology around it.
Yeah,
I mean, definitely great performers involved.
Yeah.
But
that's, a lot of punk has been like that, and the music has to be digestible too to get the point across.
Right.
You know, there's a part in the documentary when she says that people were like, "You don't even know how to play your own instruments," and they're like, "So what?"
No, I think they were a good band. I
didn't think you were saying that at all. Yeah, yeah.
But like, what is whereas like, it's not a change in form, but it is. It's almost a way like. Where I'd say, like, maybe a band like Crass is also a change in form and a change in the message of it. And
definitely. But then they reach such a smaller audience.
Right, that's true.
I mean, yeah. I love Crass, but like, I put on the Christ album, and like, okay, you could tell why this wasn't a huge hit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not catchy. It doesn't get, like, those songs aren't getting stuck in your head.
Yeah.
I mean, Crass has some catchy songs.
Well, this guy knows from catchy. Hutch knows from catchy. I kind of lost the thread in the La Tigra era. I didn't really follow her through La Tigra. And I think that was partly, they were lumped in with, like, I guess the electro clash movement that was happening in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I like her. I like these people. Actually, I like J.D. Sampson a lot.
Oh, yeah. J.D. Sampson's awesome. The men are great.
So I never saw La Tigra live, and it was a little bit like, at that time, I'm like, oh, I like Blectum from Blectum, and like, that's like an interesting, like, sort of electronic feminist noise band. But it was still definitely super, like, noise.
Mm.
So it was a different level of a thing. Then La Tigra was writing, like, very catchy, anthemic music.
Yeah.
That was like synth pop kind of.
Mm-hmm. She's got a great pop sensibility. You know, like, oh yeah, Julie Ruin. Like
that record is cool.
Record's really cool.
Yeah, I worked like at
a independent bookstore in San Francisco around the early 2000s, and every day you got to bring another employee, got to be, that was their day for music. And I worked with this girl who was a hardcore feminist, and we listened to La Tigra and Cat Power so much that like it was just like drained into my head. And I liked La Tigra a lot.
Yeah,
like, I never got to see them live, but I certainly listened to a lot of their music.
Yeah, the Julie Ruin record, I remember that coming out, and it was so lo-fi compared to everything else.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's like, to be a lo-fi record on Kill Rock Stars is like pretty like rough.
Yeah.
But
that's funny.
I heard a rumor that like Joe Preston like showed her some drum machine stuff.
Oh, really?
That was like, that might just be a rumor.
Yeah.
But yeah, now it's Julie Ruin's a band. Like, whereas that was, it's interesting in the movie, she explains how like that was like her way of doing a band after being, or being doing a solo project, right?
Yeah.
After being in this band, dealing with all the personalities of band stuff. Almost reminds me of like, yeah, like, you know, when Bob Mould put out his first solo record after Husker Du, it was like just this processing thing.
Mm.
And she talks about it like it was a way to process a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I like the whole notion of the bedroom creativity thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Something I kind of forgot about, like how creative you could be in your own bedroom with your own little four walls and your own creativity, and how big your mind could get in your imagination. And
yeah, said the podcaster. Yeah. That's like pretty much like what is good about these kinds of things. It's like the low overhead and the complete like
Well, self-control. And it's like your space. It's your own theater. It can be your own concert hall. It's whatever you want to make it. And when she was talking about making that album, she wanted to get back to just being in her bedroom and being creative and doing what she, and it's, and then, you know, like Adam Hertz says, it's like, it's a masterpiece. Like her husband, you know, Mr. Beastie Boy himself.
Well, that's actually in this thing, they talk a lot about her relationship, her marriage, which I thought was really interesting, 'cause that was all stuff that you just kind of, in our world, like those are like, I mean, they're both huge rock stars, but they're still like kind of cult rock stars. It's not like, oh, Justin Bieber and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's still like, it's still like kind of like you kind of have to, like, though I was surprised that they were like became like a great artistic couple kind of thing, the way like you think of Kim Gordon and Thurston Moore or you used to. So that kind of thing. But it's funny her talking about like feeling like embarrassed in the early days, or feeling like she had to like, and almost like this thing of she's like, you know what, I just love who I love, and like it happens to be Beastie Boy,
but it is like the scene like, did how feel that way. Everyone was like, how could she be with him,
right?
He's so
he's fighting for
such
his rights,
sexist songs,
right? That was
he wrote girl,
but then like, I feel like she was, he did evolve probably,
yeah, and they did and the band
in this
did
relationship
too.
And it, I think it, that's a good thing for sure, but it's not like, oh, you know, it's good that she came along and taught him the right thing, you know. It's like it seems like they respect each other as artists.
It was in the documentary, it's, I mean, you know, it was a very, I thought, a very touching kind of cute scene where you had Kim Gordon and I can't remember the, unfortunately, the other lady's name that was married to the Beastie Boy, we're talking about setting, trying to set them up.
Oh, really?
Because Adam Horowitz had just gotten through a big breakup.
Was it Tamara Davis? Is that
I think so.
Because she is married to Mike D.
Yeah, and they're talking about trying to set them up because they're like, it seems like they would just like each other and stuff. And I thought it was kind of cute.
Yeah. And it seems like this period of time where she kind of stops doing projects, and it was a little bit mysterious, and no one really knew why, but it turns out it was health-related.
Yeah.
Then, so that's like another big part of this that I didn't know so much about. I think I had heard that she had some health issues, but it ends up being this sort of mysterious thing that they can't diagnose. There's, like, the footage of the filmmaker, you know, hanging out with them, and, like, she's just, like, in physical pain a lot of the time, I think it definitely... ends up being Lyme disease. That's what the diagnosis ends up being. And
but during the filming of the documentary, which I thought was, you know, kind of interesting that the documentary is being filmed and then she gets the right diagnosis finally.
Yeah,
she was misdiagnosed for a long time.
Yeah.
You remember the, where they keep telling her it's like in your head because there's no way it could be all of those symptoms.
You're just hysterical, lady. That's what sucks.
I read a thing. I read a thing that the director was saying that, like, basically part of the reason they were making the film was she didn't know if she was going to live or not.
Yeah.
So it was like, I just kind of want to get my story in my own words down as much as I can.
And then what happened was the director of this film was diagnosed with Lyme disease.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wait, did they mention that in the movie?
No.
Oh, shit.
And so I think the movie she's making after this is about Lyme disease. And I think there's also... I didn't read the article. Did you read the article?
I did,
It's like, was she saying that there's women are more affected by Lyme disease?
It's not that they're... Well, they think, because autoimmune stuff with hormones. However, they're... I think the point is they're misdiagnosed a lot because male doctors are like, you're just being hysterical.
Yeah, right.
And a lot of women aren't being... what happens is guys go with the same symptoms. They get to the, oh, it's Lyme disease a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. Women are, they're like, you're just kind of being little nuts.
Yeah.
And they get to later stages, which makes it a lot harder to help them.
What, right. How do you get it?
Ticks.
Usually.
Is it always from a tick?
I believe so.
I don't think it's a bacteria. I don't think it's always from a tick, but I think it's the, like, 99%. It's a bite.
It's like being out in the woods
and
not having, like, high socks and a tick gets on you.
You got to get a tick check. Always get a tick check.
And you're in the Pacific Northwest. I don't know how it's spreading out there. But, yeah, no, I mean, it does sound really terrible. I talked to a friend
of mine
who said, like, his uncle was, like, one of the first people. I think they first really started diagnosing it in the late 70s. So his uncle was, like, one of the first people to get it. And you're kind of like it's like when they had chronic fatigue syndrome, but just, like, like 80% of your life, like, you're just, like, not able to get out.
I took antibiotics for 3 weeks afterwards. So when I got sick later, I never associated it with Lyme disease. And when it was brought up to me by different specialists, I said I already took the test.
You know, I would pull out my shitty ELISA test that's like the $20 test that the insurance company wants you to take, show it to doctors, and nobody said, oh, that's actually a crappy, totally unreliable test. But eventually I got a test called the Western blot test, and it lit up like a Christmas tree.
It's hard to explain it to other people. The expectation out there is, okay, so you had Lyme disease. Yeah, you took antibiotics, you should be better. When you've had it for 5 years and it hasn't been treated, that's not going to be the way that it works.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
It's interesting the thing you're saying about her being considered this messiah
to
probably people that are, like, in their 20s.
Yeah, definitely.
Because, like, I think we all would, like, hold her in high regard as an important figure. But, like, it's just, you can't, things like that, like, figuring out where feminism is going now, I don't think you can't just throw that on one person.
No, right?
You can't throw it on Gloria
Steinem. And it's not fair.
Yeah. And, and people, I think it's scarier when someone wants to be that voice. When someone's like, I do know the answer.
Yeah, you can't trust
someone. Freaky.
Yeah.
When someone's like, I know for sure that this is this.
Yeah. But I think she's honest because I think she did know at one point and was spreading the word, but it's been 20 years and you can't, like, it's honest to say, I don't know now.
Yeah.
You know, things are different now.
Yeah. Well, she's spending a lot of time in her beautiful house there on the lake somewhere.
And also
New
being
York
ill takes up a lot of your time. You need to focus on yourself point.
And she's still, I mean, every woman still has skin in the game as far as feminism is concerned, right? Because it still is affecting, you know, wages and just society as a whole. I saw this really interesting performance art piece. I just wanted to bring it up. It doesn't really directly relate, but there's a conceptual artist named Andrea Fraser, and she did this thing where she reenacted this KPFA show from, like, the late 70s, which was like men talking about feminism, which was like, I was like, I have to really make sure that we don't devolve into a parody like the way that was. But it was really interesting of performance. And I was thinking about that a little bit in terms of like, when we get into this, we can't let it turn into that. but I don't think any of us are trying to be authoritative about it at all. And I think it's like, we're coming at, I think a lot of people are coming at it as music fans. Probably coming to this.
Yeah, I was fans. For sure. Oh, yeah, I mean, the thing is, when they, I mean, I think that movie opens with Rebel Girl, and you're like, damn, it sounds so good.
It's like one of the best songs
yeah,
of the decade.
Yeah, it sounds, you know, when it's like, yeah, it just sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Reject All American, like, that sounds, that's a killer sounding record. It's like the least popular record, probably, but it's, or I'm not sure, but I remember, like, by the time that
there's
came out,
clunkers.
People have been like.
I think there's clunkers in there, though. But, like, well, you can't have, like, perfect everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, actually, that first record is, there's that live thing, like, the first 12-inch, there's, like, a live thing. It's just, like, an art, it's, like, art rock. It's a total mess, which, at the time, was just, like, what is happening? I don't understand what is happening here at all. But it's just, like, that thing, like, do I care if Thurston Moore likes my band? Like, all this, like, super insider-y, like, stuff.
I'm just wondering, like, are those zines still around? I'm sure people have, like, copies that they got at shows. Because she would hand out Riot Girl zines.
I should actually look at my parents' house while I'm here. I have, like, boxes of zines and old singles and, like, stuff like that.
Oh, that's cool. You should take a... If you'd find it, take a photo.
Yeah, I will.
I was a big zine collector in the early days. Actually, that's also interesting when you think about, like, how that information was spread before that weekly journalist took it into the mainstream.
Yeah.
It was just photocopies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And look at how important Kinko's was to the scene.
It was
scene.
Key,
yeah. Huge. And having a friend that worked at Kinko's or getting like one of those cards like the old,
Or you remember, they used to have like a different color drum, so you could have a different color.
Right.
You could have two colors if you're willing to sit there and try and get them to line up.
Yeah.
But
the 90s zine culture, man, is very influential. I mean, that's how you passed on information. And
I think it's before the internet too.
It's early internet. It's like there was some like early like bulletin boards and stuff.
Yeah, that's what's weird. In the Punk Singer, they talk about like when Courtney Love punched Kathleen Hanna, and they were saying how like 90. People were talking online. That had to be like 95 or something. So like Thurston Moore like made like posted. I was like, what?
Because
I had probably looked. I don't remember. Like, I didn't have email till like 97 or 98 or something. I know a lot of people that did. It was.
Yeah. I think I have Kathy's Hotmail somewhere.
I definitely had a Hotmail, but I feel like I might have had something before that. I don't know.
I had Hotmail in 96.
Yeah.
And I remember my password was 4 characters.
Yeah.
That's how, like, it was like 1 character. It was like S or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was, like, this message board on college I was on, these early, like, there was, like, stuff like The Well that sort of predates a lot of, like, web stuff. I think that was all maybe, like, hacker-based or something.
But,
like, it was San Francisco, so there was still, like, people having, like, cultural discussions. But they were even nerdier, if you can imagine.
Oof, yeah.
Well, like, it did keep out, like, the certain level of, like, YouTube commenter type people.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
But no, why did Courtney Love punch her? They never really said
why. Courtney Love was always doing. Remember when she like threw shit at Madonna at South by Southwest? I feel like she was just kind of starting.
Just starting.
Who knows?
Shit.
I don't know. I wasn't there. But
yeah.
It seems like she didn't know either. Like, it seemed like she's like, well, I don't know why she did that.
Well, she mentioned the press said that they were in a big fight. And she's like, no, I was standing there watching, I think it was Sonic Youth. Mm-hmm. And she just walked up and punched her in the face.
Yeah, but that's like another good point that Kathleen Hanna makes in that movie is the press is usually trying to paint everything as a cat fight.
Yeah.
Interview one woman and try to get her to say something bad about another woman, and then that's the whole story.
If the woman is Courtney Love, it's easy, though.
Yeah.
That's the only problem with that.
And how they were kind of dismissing the entire Riot Girl thing with like, oh, these are just girls with problems from home. They all have father problems.
Like the media?
Yeah, media. Like they were just diminishing them and dismissing them as just like, oh, these girls with some home, like they grew up with some fathers that were evil and, you know, and she's like, it really wasn't like that. I mean, everyone has their own story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting that Joan Jett produced some of their stuff.
Yeah.
Was it that album you're talking about?
It's that single. The Rebel Girl single.
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting. That's something I learned from this doc.
Yeah.
I totally had forgotten that. I didn't think I knew that until.
I think there's two versions of that song. I think. I think there's like a single version, and then there's an LP,
a
version.
Different version. And then there's the so I they think. At one point they go to Adam Horowitz. Well, they Kathleen's talking about Woodstock '99, which was just horrible. Mm-hmm. And I almost went to that. I'm so glad I didn't go.
Really?
I was gonna go.
Were you in California then? You were.
I was. Yeah. I was gonna try to go to that one, which ended for some people who don't remember ended with like riots and fires and rapes and horrific. And I remember, I think then it was like bottles of water were like $12 or something.
It was like, crazy. There was some like fires, and then there was like expensive water.
Yeah, well, if you wanted to put a fire out, you need to get your credit card, apparently. Yeah. But then she says in the doc that she and Adam talk, and she said, if you get up on the dais at the MTV Awards, please say something about it.
Right.
And then they show Adam saying something, but I completely forgotten. And then I remember seeing that footage of him just being like, hey, this is wrong, and I can't believe. And then he's like, once he said that, it was like a fart in church, like the party atmosphere just died out. And then he said it was like the party atmosphere died out until like Uncle Cracker got on stage.
Yeah, right,
and then
yeah.
it was back.
Yeah.
But that was around the time like the Beastie Boys started to get into more like social justice-y things and like the Free Tibet and things like that. So they were changing from what they used to be. So she obviously had this longer 3-hour cut. So I was going to say there's probably stuff she left out, but she probably has it. There's probably like there would be extras of interviews and things.
Oh, yeah.
Probably just did not make this cut. I think I watched this with my girlfriend who wasn't particularly a fan, and she really liked the documentary.
Yeah, I think it's well made.
It's
I
think it's great. And let me ask you, why do you think the film succeeds?
Because you have because there's a real story there. It's not just about the band. Because it's about like the band and then her life after the band and her illness. Like there is a real arc to the story. I think. If they were doing just a movie about Bikini Kill, they would obviously just need more, and they would have to focus more on whatever,
Which we don't need to know.
Yeah, whatever the real drama of the band was, I don't have to tell you guys, you know what makes the documentary good? Just like something.
Drama,
yeah.
Yeah, some kind of monster. It could be that kind of thing. But we didn't.
Yeah, right.
There's no footage of it. So.
I kind of like that about. I mean, to me, a lot of times, Some Kind of Monster is a good example of knowing too much about a band you like is not going to make you like them anymore.
Yeah.
A lot of bands, I wish I would have never even seen a photo of the band because the more mysterious, the more mysterious a band is, especially for music more than like other things, I think. Like,
look out for the new
Thermals
record.
You need to know too much,
Hutch has a bag on his head.
Yeah, exactly. No photos.
Oh, yeah. It has kind of a perfect ending, which is like a lot of people paying tribute to her and the music.
Yeah.
And a bunch of other people that are like artists in New York. Like,
Kim Gordon's there.
Peers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they get to end it on this positive note. It's like she's, she's still dealing with her illness, but she knows what it is now. And she's able to go. And like they drive out of their house and they go. It's like they're them packing up to leave their apartment.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cute.
Well, and the last shot is her playing the drums. Like she's still a working artist. She's still, creating and
which is also
people
like
still
kind
care
of,
about her a lot.
Yeah, this is interesting. She's still. I'm like, wait, she's only like what, like 42 or something? She's still mid career for.
Yeah,
a lot of,
yeah.
Like it's just she was. It really explains a lot that like the illness stuff is like, oh yeah, we would have seen a lot more of her in the last 10 years if she wasn't dealing with this.
Yeah, there's a really touching and sad scene where she had just taken her pills, and she shows her hand of the cocktails of pills she has to take.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's like, I'm having a reaction because, as the doctor explains, the bacteria reacts against all the all the drugs that you're taking because it's just like, I'm going to succeed, and it really fucks up people. And she's on the couch, and I think it's Adam that must be filming, and she's just like, I wanted to show this because I want people to see just like how hard this is.
Yeah.
And she's like, this isn't even as bad as it gets. Mm-hmm. It's really sad. I mean, I didn't know much about Lyme disease before seeing this, and I did some research today just to see what it's all about. It sounds just horrible, but it's kind of a story. I mean, is it a story of redemption at all, do you think?
I don't think there's like a thing to redeem.
No.
Yeah, I don't think so.
It just is like, I think the illness just explains a lot of like, oh, this person was like really integral to a lot of cultural stuff, and then we only get little bits of her here and there.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's not like a cause and effect thing. It's not like she got ill because she did drugs, and it's not like because she partied when she's bikini kill, and now she's paying the price. It's there's something, there's like, it's very separate.
I would say don't go into nature. That's like the message I got. Like, avoid nature at all costs.
I think too that I think people were wondering what happened to her, right?
I think it's a little bit more that.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit more
like you
that.
Were so big and then you just kind of vanished. And I think she was saying in the doc too, she didn't really know what was going on, and she was just like, it's just too hard to tour and just be on stage.
I also think it's like really hard. Okay, the thing that she might have in common with her husband is like, it's really hard to live down this intense thing you did like when you were like 21 or 22. Right? Like, that's a hard legacy to try and be like, I have a new band. I'm like, can you play some of the old songs?
Right, yeah.
Like, you're going to always deal with that. So, well, that's another thing.
I was going to say, like, Bikini Kill, at this point, they're a band like the Smiths. Like, never, still haven't reformed. If they would, it would be crazy. It would be huge if they did. But the longer they don't, the cooler, you know, it never... People's view of them, it just stays perfect in their head.
Right. It can be just this untouched thing.
What is it? I'm sorry, but what is it about some people that are a genius on every level? I mean, I think we've all probably met somebody, even whether or not they're recognized by the mainstream media or not, but everything they seem to do is just seems genius.
Yeah.
Including what they wear, what they say, how they do it, where
Shia
they
LaBeouf.
Do it. Like Shia LaBeouf. Yeah. Ovs.
Yeah.
How does that manifest this stuff? I've always wondered about that kind of stuff. Like, what is it about that person that just is able to do that?
Well, I don't know.
I mean,
just pure personality?
I think a lot of it comes from like confidence, like the confidence to do. Like, you know, when you talk about when they were at Evergreen, she's like, you know, we're only 18. How can you put on a fashion show? She's like, I'm just going to do it. Like, just confident. But also when she, you know, she tells stories about like her mom saying we're gonna do a trust fall, and then she just lets her fall.
Yeah.
And also her dad saying after a show, you wanna get ice cream? Well, yeah, because only someone that would make such a fool of themselves would deserve an ice cream. So it's like, it's weird. It's not like her parents, it didn't sound like her parents always like told her like, you're so great, you can do anything.
Yeah.
The best thing for me about this documentary is you've seen documentaries about musicians where they weren't able to license the music.
Oh, yeah. That's
and it's
true.
Like
that's
a joke. Like the fact that they had all that footage and they were able to use all these songs from both of her bands.
Yeah.
Like that's crucial for any documentary about a musician, obviously. Yeah,
That's, I think, what held up that Leon Russell doc for a while, too. And also Decline, I think.
And do you remember this old NWA documentary from, like, 10 years ago? Mm-hmm. I wish I think it was called, like, Welcome to Death Row or something. They couldn't license any. It's so silly because it's, like, it's just all these, just like cheap knockoff beats.
Yeah. Just two bars of each song straight out of, and then just stops.
Yeah. Nothing.
So we end each of our shows with asking our guests to recommend another doc. Do you have something else you'd like to recommend
for
our
listeners?
And not the Jinx, right?
Not the Jinx, not Keith Richards.
No, you could. It could be the Jinx.
It could be the Jinx.
Yeah, I definitely watch the Jinx.
Wait, and you guys haven't done Dig yet, have you?
No, we haven't done Dig.
Yeah, of course, Dig. I live in Portland. Dig is about the Dandy Warhols, who are from Portland, and Brian Jonestown Massacre. And they worked. It's one of those movies where they worked... The woman who directed it, I think, for like
Andy
11
Timoner.
Years.
Yeah,
like 11 or 12 years. So it's one of those things where so much happened while they were making it. Mm-hmm.
It's like
both
Boyhood.
Those bands are fascinating.
It's like the Boyhood of music.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well,
I fully recommend that.
Right.
Thanks for coming down to the basement and chatting with us. Hutch Harris. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. You can find episodes of SupDoc on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please review, subscribe, and rate.
And you can follow us on Twitter at SupDocPodcast and online at SupDocPodcast.com.
This show is produced by Will Scovel, and our theme music is by David Siegel.
If you want to suggest a documentary or a future guest, please email us at SupDocPodcast@gmail.com.